With Ken and MJ on the Flower Power Hours, 6 and 7 p.m.
This is 90.1 KPFT FM and FM HD1 Houston, with translators at 89.5 FM K208DG Galveston and 91.9 FM K220KC Huntsville. Houston's community station, 90.1 KPFT, a Pacifica radio station.
That is the percolating beat of Ray Lynch's Clouds Below Your Knees. And that means it's 5 p.m. on a Thursday, and time for So What's Your Story? We're the only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to stories and storytelling right here on KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston Community Radio. Well, I'm your host today, Eric Heen, and I'm backed up by the most talented team on radio. And here on So What's Your Story, every week we feature new guests who'll take us on magical journeys through their inspiring and thought-provoking stories. Well, today we have three very inspiring guests, and each of them will share stories of prevailing over huge obstacles to get where they are today. Our guests are Mike Feeney, Rusty McDonald, and Tom McAuliffe. Well, our first guest tonight is Mike Feeney. Mike is a highly sought-after keynote speaker, corporate drumming event facilitator, author, and luggage enthusiast. Mike is the author of the book Transforming Stigma, How to Become a Mental Wellness Superhero. As a 2017 Elite Award winner, Mike is recognized as one of the 100 most influential people in the healthcare industry for his work as a patient advocate. Hey, Mike. Thanks so much for being here on So What's Your Story?
Well, thank you for having me, Eric, and hello to your listeners out there. My story is very complicated, but I'm going to summarize it for everyone. When we talk about mental health, we're talking about three things generally: thoughts, feelings, and behavior. What's interesting about that is you can't see someone's thoughts. We like to think we can perceive feelings or get them through emojis, but you can absolutely observe behavior. And so my journey began with behavior as a child. I had trouble with angry outbursts. And this started when I was maybe 6 years old. I would just get angry. And I came from a wonderful home, by the way. My parents loved my brother and I so much. And it led to me getting expelled from school in the fourth grade for my extreme behavior, getting into fights and stuff like that. And throughout school, I had been expelled from three schools by the time I got to 10th grade. And also, I was exploding at home, and so I was hospitalized in a mental hospital. Now, let me give some more context to that. You know, just because we all explode with anger, right? We all do at times. But when you're intensely angry for long periods of time and punching things and destroying things, that's not appropriate. And I didn't know how to control my anger, and so I was put in the mental hospital three times. And I also want to say this, and just to be real, because I believe in transparency, when I was 10 years old, I was struggling with what I would later learn as depression. You know, oftentimes when it comes to mental health, we have a hard time articulating things. It's not something you can put in a box, and that's what makes it very challenging for people to get the help they need. You know, it's one thing if you break your wrist, you know, we all know what you should do. With that mental health, it's just complicated. But for me, I was so overwhelmed with this sadness, and I just wanted the pain to go away, that I attempted to die by suicide at age 10. And my mom saved my life. And had she not done that, I wouldn't be here talking to you. And by the time I had been gotten to age 15, I had been expelled from three schools, hospitalized in a mental hospital three times, several suicide attempts, lots of self-harm, violent at home, and on about five different medications. So I was the poster child for an at-risk youth. I was the poster child. That is when my life changed. The fact that no school wanted me was actually a gift, because one of the few schools that I could get into was a performing arts high school that would allow me to play drums. And drumming was something that I started in fifth grade. You know, kids do a bunch of activities, right? Drumming was one of the many ones. But drumming was the only thing that really calmed me down. And so getting into this school for the performing arts changed my mental health trajectory. This is very important to all of you out there listening. Changed my trajectory. It didn't take away my mental health challenges, but it made me better able to cope. Fast forward, I became a professional drummer in New York City, and I also do corporate drumming in the workplace now, so I get to have the honor of sharing the gift that helped me with other people who might be struggling. And nowadays, I am the CEO of a company that does mental health training throughout the world in the workplace. And you know, it's nice because it's not coming from a mental health professional. That's not me. It's coming from someone with lived experience. And I want to say to all the listeners out there, you know, I know what it's like to struggle. I know what it's like to struggle and be at your worst. And nowadays, I can tell you, I battle depression, anxiety, and obsessive compulsive disorder. I go to therapy, support group. But at the same time, I know what it's like to thrive and do really well in life. And it is possible to be able to have mental health challenges, which we all do at some level, and also thrive.
So tell us a little more about this drumming.
The fun stuff.
How did you choose drumming? What was it about that?
Well, there was this show I used to watch as a kid called Sesame Street. And on Sesame Street, there were like these little musical interludes that they would have between cartoons and segments, you know. You know, and you hear the drums, and I was always fascinated by the sound. And I'll never forget hearing a school band play, and the drums were this thunder that just went through my chest. I just wanted to have it. But the thing is, I decided to start doing it in fifth grade, and I'll never forget holding drumsticks for the first time, Eric. Holding a drumstick and hitting a drum, greatest feeling ever. And that led to what I would later learn is a major coping skill for me, a major tool for expressing my emotions, and also my livelihood for a good amount of time. So that's the story.
You became a pro drummer. Now, I know you do this sort of drumming therapy. You help kids. What, they get on the drums and start banging their aggressions out? Or how does that work?
The drumming allows people to have a real opportunity to feel included in something. Mm-hmm. And what's amazing, Eric, is, you know, people do this drumming thing with me. In one sense, like, they turn to children. It's kind of cool to see, you know, executives in the C-suite turn to kids. But also, some people start crying because they haven't ever felt like that.
Yeah. I never really envisioned drumming as therapy, but the way you talk about it, yeah, I can see it. It creates inclusion. It creates some, I guess, catharsis.
Right, right. And also, you know, as a society, we all know it's not appropriate to hit a person or an object when you're angry. But drumming is a safe space to actually hit something, if you think about it, and it's rewarded.
You get rewarded for being aggressive.
Yes!
Well, Mike, when you were a kid in these psychiatric hospitals, getting expelled from all these schools, did you ever dream that you'd be where you are now?
No, I did not dream that I would be on the radio talking about this to anyone, because when it comes to mental health, most of us don't want to talk about it. It's interesting. It's like, in one sense, it's the most popular topic in the world right now, yet no one wants to talk about their mental health. And so my parents had basically told me, like, you know, no one should ever find out about this because it's going to affect my career, my social life, all that stuff. So I never imagined that I'd be talking about it. But I want to be honest with you and say that, you know, talking about it is one of the greatest things you can do to free yourself from something that's holding you hostage. You know, everyone listening right now to this interview, all of you listening have something on your mind you've never shared with anyone. We all do. And chances are that thing you've never shared is holding you hostage. The moment you share about it in a safe way, whether it's with a friend or a therapist, you free yourself, and it's a beautiful experience.
Yes. Yeah, and the beat goes on.
Yes, it does.
See what I did there? You're a drummer. I said the beat goes on.
I love the transition.
Now, we don't got a lot of time left here, but in your bio, I got to ask you this. It says you are a luggage enthusiast. What's so great about luggage?
Oh, my. Okay, so... Eric, right here next to me as we're doing this interview, I'm in my New York City apartment. I've got my suitcase out. So it's just funny that you're talking about this. I travel so much for work. I'm constantly traveling. So when you travel regularly for work, you know, you try to make it the best experience that it can be, because travel can be stressful, right? So luggage is a thing that's really, really important. Finding the right suitcase for yourself to actually, like, this is going to sound so silly, but like getting you from one terminal to the other during a layover, those wheels on the suitcase are so important. I love that we get to talk about this. So basically, I really love discovering travel hacks and good luggage and stuff like that.
Well, you know, I'm never going to look at luggage the same way again.
Okay.
Well, Mike, before we let you go here today, can you tell us more about how we could find out more about your work? Where would we go?
Absolutely. And first of all, thank you all for listening and tuning into this today. The way you spell my last name is V-E-N-Y. That's V like in Victor, E as in Edward, N as in Nancy, Y as in yellow. So if you just type my name in Google, you can find my website, www.mikevini.com. But I also have courses on a website called Open Sesame, courses for the workplace on having the conversation at work and stuff like that. And also we have a course that we just made for educators called Fill Your Cup, The Exhausted Educator's Guide to Emotional Wellness. So I invite you to check all that out and feel free to reach out to me if I could ever be of help to you.
So we Google V-E-N-Y and that'll be kind of a portal to all this other stuff.
That's all right there.
Okay, Mike. Hey, Mike, I'm going to ask you something. Could you kind of ease us out of this segment? If you got a couple of pencils or pens there, something to just bang on the table.
Okay, hold on for one second right here.
Draw us out of this segment.
I'm gonna ease you out of this segment. Give me one second here, Eric.
Yes, love it. Okay, Mike, well, it's been a delight having you here. You're a very inspirational guy. Maybe we'll have you back sometime.
Thank you so much, Eric.
You bet. Well, our next guest today to tell a story of overcoming insurmountable obstacles is Tom McAuliffe. Tom is a former photojournalist with the U.S. Navy, and he's presently an author of several books. His most recent book is a biography of his grandfather, and it's called Mr. Mulligan, The Life of Champion Armless Golfer, Tommy McAuliffe.
So, Tom, it's great to have you here.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Tom, I've begun reading your book here about Mr. Mulligan, about your grandfather, Tommy McAuliffe, and he is one of the most inspirational people I have ever heard of. Now, I can't imagine how somebody could golf without any arms. So could you kind of talk us through the mechanics on that? How did he golf?
Sure. As people will see on the cover of the book, he had this technique where he put the club in between his chin, his lower chin, and his shoulder. And Tommy McAuliffe had what they call a perfect example of what they call the full body swing. Didn't shoot the ball very far down the fairway, but it was straight. And that's a big thing for golfers. As somebody who's cursed with the slice, you know, that's a big thing. So it wasn't really long down the fairway, but was always straight. And he was deadly on the greens. Bobby Jones, the former U.S. champion, U.S. Open champion and Olympic gold medal Olympian, actually made some special clubs. They were still regulation, but they adjusted the face of the club. So with Grandpa Tommy's full-bodied swing, he could connect with the ball a little bit better.
Mm-hmm. Wow, Bobby Jones, he's one of the big ones.
So yeah, he played with Bobby Jones, Walter Hagen, Arnold Palmer, played with all the biggies.
That is incredible. So let's hear the whole story about your grandfather.
Okay. I'll just tell you, it's Mr. Mulligan, the life of champion armless golfer Tommy McAuliffe. And that's kind of tongue-in-cheek because naturally there is no championship for armless golfers. He's the only one. But basically, he lost both of his arms in a tragic streetcar accident. Remember those streetcars that used to be back in the day where there would be two electric things above them and they would go down on tracks through the city and such? One day in a September, after the first rain of the fall, things get very slick up there in up north in the cities, and he slipped and knocked himself out with both of his arms across the tracks. And before anybody noticed or could do anything, a 20-ton streetcar came and severed both of his arms just below the shoulder. Mm. Now, what's interesting in the book, you'll see, is the number 13 plays throughout his life. Got married on the 13th, graduated on the 13th, signed his first showbiz vaudeville contract on the 13th. You'll never guess the number of the streetcar that hit him.
Oh,
2013. Mm-hmm. Isn't that something? Mm-hmm. So basically, here he is, finally got up, dusted himself off. His house was right across the street from the tracks, right on the tracks, basically, on the street with tracks. And coincidentally enough, to show you how the big guy upstairs works, it was also right across the street from the golf course. So God was laying tracks for him right from the get-go. And of course, when he was 7, 8, 9, that time frame, he started to caddy over at the golf course. And the book is not about golf or how to play golf. It's about the principles that he learned in golf that he applied to his life. Mm-hmm. And he basically, he remembers being like semi-conscious and people talking in his, even his family members saying that he was going to wind up selling pencils on the corner or it would be better if he had passed. I mean, these are his family members. Mm-hmm. And he said later in life, he said, I could hear them. I could hear them all the time. And quite frankly, he told me, he said, I just got mad. How dare they think that I can't compete with anybody else? You know, they severed my arms. They didn't sever my brain. Uh-huh. And he developed a philosophy over his life called no handicaps, where basically the only excuse is one that's in your mind. Taught himself how to play near par golf, played a par round 4 times in his life. Traveled the world, played golf in 49 states, Australia, and Canada in the course of 1 year. Mm. And then during vaudeville, which is kind of interesting, he developed a show called the Lucky 13 Shots. Mm-hmm. And did back in that day, you had these vaudeville variety shows. And there would be a magician and maybe a singer and a juggler. And Tommy would do things. We have pictures, for example, there's pictures in the book of my dad lying flat on his back with a golf tee in his mouth and Grandpa Tommy with no arms getting a golf ball off my dad's face. So that's where I get my good looks.
Your dad had faith in his dad, I can tell you that much.
I guess. So put him, you know, taught himself how to write, take notes, put himself through school, and then later in life, after vaudeville, kind of morphed into this pseudo evangelist for disability rights, worked with the Roosevelt administration in 1936 to pass one of the first anti-discrimination laws against disability.
Great.
And, you know, was really adamant about the fact that, you know, he don't want no handout. He just wants equal time and equal opportunity.
Yes.
Which was kind of refreshing back in the day. He really is equivalent to, and I've had people say this, Helen Keller, for example. He met and was a big fan of a guy named Dr. James Allen, who wrote a book called As a Man Thinketh. Kind of interesting idea. Other people are going to think about you what you think about you. So the book is doing phenomenally well on Amazon, Kindle, got ebook. We're working on the audiobook right now, which is kind of interesting.
So it sounds to me, Tom, like he was a lot more than just a golfer. He was an activist.
Yeah, it was an actor. Was a publisher. He started a magazine called The Crutch and Cane that had up to 30,000 subscribers. He was the sports editor for the Buffalo News, Buffalo, New York. That's kind of how he got to rub elbows with a lot of the heavyweights like Walter Hagen and Bobby Jones and Arnold Palmer. And then interestingly enough, I found out that many times when a politician would never allow a lobbyist to be in his office or to be alone with a lobbyist, they would always have Tommy around and he would say, you know, and we wouldn't talk politics, but on the back nine, I'd slip him a few ideas about that. So
were you pretty close to him?
I have really fond memories of him, but I was very young. Mm-hmm. But like, for example, I remember being in his office. He used to have these two huge black Royal typewriters and would put a pencil in his mouth and hit the keys one at a time. The companion book to Mr. Mulligan is called No Handicaps. Mm-hmm. And it's something that he wrote, 25,000 words, one letter at a time. Whoa. With a pencil in his mouth. And it's more of a technical treatise on overcoming your handicap and using the power of the mind to do that. And it's called No Handicaps. I edited it. He wrote it. And here he is after passing in 1967, all these years later, he's now a published author.
Like his grandson.
Yeah. You know, we were saying off air right now, this weekend in New Market County, Cork, is the McAuliffe International Family Reunion. Mm-hmm. And clan, what they call the Clan Rally. There's been a heritage center that's been established there. That's the site of Castle McAuliffe, which back in the 15th century, we used to own all that stuff. Mm-hmm. We used to own all that land over there. And I'll tell you this quick story. So about 5 years ago, I go and I track down where Castle McAuliffe was. And the farm is now owned by the O'Brien family. And so he allows us to camp out on his land. And then he says, I'll take it out tomorrow morning and we'll show you exactly where it is. So I'm sleeping in the tent that night and I've got these visions of, you know, National Geographic castles with moats and drawbridges and, you know, the whole nine yards. We get up the next morning real early. We start hiking and big stickers, you know, up chest high. He's got this machete out in front of us. He's hacking away. About 45 minutes later, we come to this clearing, and in the clearing is a huge pile of rocks. And he turns to me and he says, straight faced, ah, but you should have seen her 400 years ago. She was really something to see.
Oh, those Irishmen.
I could have smacked them.
You had to use your imagination on that one, apparently.
Yes. But so that's kind of happening in the old home country. And my book is over there. We sent a bunch of copies for free. And we're going to donate part of the proceeds, part of the profit from the book to the Disabled American Veterans, which was very dear to Grandpa Tommy's heart. Uh-huh. Wherever he went, he would always make a point of going to the local crippled children's home or DAV or USO. Was really disappointed in his life of not being able to serve in the military. Uh-huh. He really wanted to be a baseball player. And that's kind of interesting because this is book one of a 5-book series called the McAuliffe series. Mm-hmm. And the next one I'm working on, which will come out next month, is called Nuts. Mm-hmm. And it's about General Tony McAuliffe, who said nuts to the Germans in World War II when they demanded his surrender.
Right.
And then after that, we're doing Krista McAuliffe of the space shuttle. And then we're doing Mad Dog McAuliffe, who was a Detroit Tigers 1968 World Series shortstop. And then lastly, Governor McAuliffe, life of the party.
Are you related to all these McAuliffes that you know?
Yeah, you know, all of the McAuliffes kind of trace their lineage back to Clan Ollie in County Cork. In the early 16th century, John McAuliffe, Chief John McAuliffe, chief of the Klan. You know, we're all distant relatives and cousins in the McAuliffe family. Of course, Grandpa Tommy was my grandfather, General Tony McAuliffe. I'm also being assisted by his nephew. He was related to my father's brother's cousin. Then we go to Krista McAuliffe. Steve McAuliffe, her husband, is my Uncle Johnny's son. And then we go to Terry McAuliffe, and we don't know. We don't actually, you know, I live down here in Republican country, so we keep that really quiet.
Who knows? Well, let's talk a little about Krista McAuliffe for those listeners who may not know who we're talking about here.
Yes. In fact, I can reach right over here and show you a patch that was given to me by Mrs. Corrigan, Krista's mother. Hang on one second. Let me just reach over. And here it is right here. Of course, our listeners can't see this, but this is a NASA, official NASA mission patch.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really, truly a tragedy because basically what happened was they got go fever. And what's little known, research is...
Tom, let's back up here a little bit. Sure. Krista McAuliffe was the teacher.
Yes, she was the first teacher, first civilian, mm-hmm. and first teacher in space. And this is the Space Shuttle Challenger in 1983 timeframe. Mm-hmm. Basically, what happened is the weather got really, really cold, got down to freezing the night before the launch. Mm-hmm. And the O-rings, which they knew, the O-rings shrank, allowing hydrogen to leak out. And what's coming out now and what's other researchers and journalists have shown is that basically they got go fever, mm-hmm. and that President Reagan they had planned on doing a live broadcast from the shuttle during the State of the Union the following days. Mm-hmm. And that was the go. And the engineers from Morton Thiokol told them that we were not going to stand behind this, and they went and did it anyway.
Yeah. So you cover all that in you will cover all that.
We will. We're working on that. You know, we're trying to get out there one word at a time. But I'm in touch with their family, and NASA, and they've both been very, very cooperative. So I'm looking forward to that one.
Super. Okay, so we got Krista McAuliffe, we got General McAuliffe, we got your grandfather, we got the baseball player. So it's a series of books on your near relatives and distant relatives, the McAuliffes.
Right, the McAuliffe series. And they'll all be available by my website or by Amazon or Kindle. We're really reaching out to the ebook segment and now the audiobook segment. I think I read a study from Stanford that said that this year, for the first time, audiobooks and ebooks, digital books, are going to outsell regular print books. I'm pretty old school. I like to have an old book in my hand.
Sure.
But, you know, the wave of the future. Mm-hmm. People can drive down the road and listen to their favorite book.
Yeah.
That's kind of cool.
Got to admit, I like the convenience of my Kindle. Got 1,000 books in there. Most of them are free. So how did you get started writing? Did you always write all the way along, or was it after your career in the Navy?
Well, I was a photojournalist in the Navy and went to a special DOD program that they have at the University of Syracuse, where you basically get out of the service for a year. You get to grow your hair long, and you go to Syracuse and you study journalism and mass communications, video and magazine layout and design. So I was able to do that. And then I went to All Hands Magazine, which is a monthly Navy publication. Talks about the Navy's training programs and different things like that. Mm-hmm. So was in the Navy for almost 8 years as a photojournalist, mm-hmm. and then got out and became a magazine journalist and magazine editor, was contributing editor of Digital Content Magazine. And then three things I think happened to get me to one. Well, the most important thing was I got tired of Simon and Schuster to call me. I kept waiting for the big publishers to call, but they never did. So heck, I turned 65. And as I started looking back at the men who had impact in my life And the technology is such now that you can produce a book. The second thing, I think, so the first thing was I turned 65. I started looking back a little bit. The second thing was I took up that crazy game of putting that damn little hole, that little ball in that hole with the flag. That's one of the most satisfying and exasperating games ever invented, I think.
And you did it with two arms.
That's right. Ain't that the truth? And then third, about a year and a half ago in one of our old houses, we found up in the attic a old chest full. It was like something straight out of a movie. An old chest full of old press clippings, his manuscript, the manuscript that he self-typed. Wow. And a bunch of photographs. And that kind of led me down the road to want to do this. Uh-huh. I think his story is truly inspirational. Everybody that's been reading it tells me so. And certainly in these crazy times, we could use all the inspiration we can get.
No doubt about that.
Always. I really appreciate stories. The opportunity of being able to be with you and your listeners. Public radio is a super important thing, especially these times. So I hope people go and support their local public radio station. Mm-hmm. It's where you can get the content you can't get anywhere else.
Exactly. Okay, Tom, thank you so much for being here and for those inspirational stories, and best of luck to you.
Thank you. Let me just give one last plug. And if people want to follow along with me, they can go to www.authortommcauliffe. That's McAuliffe, McAuliffe. AuthorTomMcAuliffe.com.
Okay, Tom.
Awesome, Eric. Thank you so much. God bless.
You bet. You too. Bye-bye. Well, we are going to take a break now for station identification and to make a few announcements. This is Eric Keene, and you're listening to So What's Your Story on KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston Community Radio. We're at 89.5 in Galveston and 91.9 FM for our friends in Huntsville. The sponsor of our program is the Houston Storytellers Guild, and they hold a virtual story swap the fourth Tuesday of every month. So their next one will be the 26th of July, and anybody can tune into that. For more information, go to HoustonStorytellers.org and find out more about their organization. Our friends at the Moth Storytelling Organization, they hold a story slam the second Tuesday of every month down at the Warehouse Live. So their next slam will be next week, July 12th, and the theme will be nature. So all the stories will be based on the subject of nature. And our program, So What's Your Story, we've got a Facebook page. You can learn all about us and our program there. Just go to Facebook and go to So What's Your Story. Now let's get back to our stories. We got three excellent storytellers sharing stories of how they have overcome huge obstacles and prevailed.
Well, my next guest today is Rusty McDonald. Rusty is a multi-book author, a celiac speaker, and full-time single mom. She's internationally known for sharing her story of abuse and poverty. Rusty lives in Florida and hosts an international radio talk show every Thursday called Living and Thriving with Rusty. Hey, Rusty, it's great to have you here on
So What's Your Story. Thank you so much for having me. How are you today?
Pretty good. Oh, before we get started, what is a celiac? I don't know what that is.
Celiac is an autoimmune disease in your intestine where you're allergic to wheat, rye, and barley.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, we got that out of the way. Now, I've read a little bit about your life story, Rusty. You have been through a lot. You've endured some severe abuse. And how did you find the courage to start sharing your story about this abuse?
An old friend's work friend said once, you don't know what you don't know until you know. And I had lots of problems thereafter. We'll get into that later. But that always stuck with me. And as I started relating that quote to my life, it really is true. You don't know what you don't know until you know.
Huh, yeah. Well, let's hear about what you've gone through and how you've overcome it.
Whew. So in a very small and broad nutshell, my childhood was filled with lots of abuse, lots of poverty. I attended 23 public schools. we were transient at best. And honestly, as a child, it was miserable because every 6 to 8 months we moved. So I never was able to formulate friends. And I've almost died 3 times. I've had cancer and celiac disease, which I was diagnosed later on in life. And you can die from it. You can have several complications if you're not aware of it.
But you're better, getting better now, right?
Every day.
Super. So now tell me about your childhood more. It sounds like you went through a lot. Any specific stories on what you went through?
Oh, gosh, there's tons. I think prospectively, you know, when you share childhood stories and childhood traumas, I think in the beginning of healing, it's pain and suffering and you're a victim and all of that. And I don't see myself that way. But, you know, I was born to a 6-foot-tall Cherokee Indian woman in the 70s, and she was 17, 16, you know, so there was just all kinds of things against her, all kinds of forces against her, brown skin and her age and Kentucky. Can we say enough? You know, very, I think a lot of challenges there. Here's this kid who made it very clear on my 18th birthday that she was going to abort me. I don't want to diagnose her. I hope that everything's going well for her. I don't have any ill will towards her. But it wasn't an easy path with her as her child. You know, she had 2 more children after me, much, much, much later. And I don't really know them. I don't really know any of my biological family because that's not something that I was allowed to have.
So what did you go through in like school and so forth from the other kids? Were you bullied at all?
Huge, huge. And actually the one story that I will share that was terrifying was we'll just pick a day of the week. Tuesday night, let's say I was supposed to do the dishes and there was a macaroni and cheese pot. I remember this like it was yesterday and it was 30 years ago. There was a macaroni and cheese pot that I soaked. You know, everything's crusty, everything's stuck on it. I'm going to soak it. And I woke up to the water, the crust, and the pan on my head the next morning. And because I didn't do all the dishes. And so I went to school and I'm already clearly visibly upset, physically upset because it was a big, big brawl. And this young girl decided to start flapping her gums. And I snapped. I snapped and I just tore into her with every ounce of my, I want to say 12-year-old self at that time. And there was a couple of adults that had to pull me off. And I don't remember. To this day, I don't remember exactly what happened. I blacked out. But I was going to destroy her. And that's when I found out I had PTSD and all of this stuff. It was quite frightening that I was becoming my mother. And then I was moved again to a new school and a new world and lived on the streets for a little over a year in Florida.
Tell us about that. Living on the streets, you lived in utter poverty, it sounds like.
Oh, completely. Completely. And it's really funny. A few years ago, I brought my daughter through my old stomping grounds when I was here. Because I grew up here and I moved up north and moved back. Lots of moving. And the old gas station and old church that we used to sleep in are still here after all these years. I was like, whoa. I kind of figured they would have torn all of that down because it's been a good 30 years.
Hold on. Wait a minute. You slept at a gas station?
Oh, yeah. There was a gas station and a church next to each other. So the flock of children that were homeless, we would go from the gas station to the church, the gas station to the church, and that was our rotation. And if back then, many, many moons ago, to be part of the flock, you had to smoke cigarettes. So I had to learn how to smoke cigarettes pretty quickly because that was kind of like this bonding, sharing community thing. Because we didn't always have food. We didn't always have shelter from the rain. This is Florida. And, you know, it can be a very scary place, especially at night and especially as a teenage girl.
So. But you said there's kind of a community of homeless people.
Yeah, and we'd all sleep on the same church steps as a group just to be as safe as possible. There was gang violence. There was, we called them fists back then, many moons ago. Guns were kind of frowned upon because that was the coward's way out. whereas now it's the popular thing to do, I guess. We were raised with a different level of respect for each other at that time. And it's sad to see that the kids don't have that kind of respect nowadays, because, you know, you can punch it out and everybody's good, black eye, whatever. But shooting somebody and killing them, that's not, that doesn't help anybody, and it doesn't help the person that's behind the gun either, because they have to remember that. So, it's tough.
You were with your mother at this time, right?
Or... when I was living on the streets? No. She had shipped me back to Florida with her husband at the time. And while we were both down here, he found out that she was interested in somebody else and wanting to leave him. So he took the first Greyhound out of town to go and save his marriage and left me in a peculiar situation, put it nicely. And the situation didn't work out. So I packed my bags and said, I'm out. And
well, Rusty, now you were there on the streets, homeless. It sounds like a hopeless situation, like a dead end in life, but there
No, God, it was a better life than I had living with my mother.
Okay.
So no, it wasn't a dead end, because I was tall, and if I do say, I was a good looking kid, and I got a job under the guise of a different name, which back then you could get away with pretty easily. And I got a job doing flooring with a floor company, and I swore up and down I was 16, but I was tall enough where I could probably have made it. And that worked out really well until they found out I really was, and then they called the police on me, and I got the cuffs, man.
you started working with the flooring, and where did you go from there?
So when I got the cuffs, I ended up in a juvenile detention center here in Florida in Titusville. The one thing that's really difficult about Florida, and always has been, even though they have the best children protection in the country, they have an absolutely abhorrent DHS. They have an abhorrent case manager. They go through case managers like people go through crack. It's just terrible. And so at that time, they were so overrun with foster homes, or not having enough foster homes for the amount of foster children, that I had to go to a juvenile detention center. And I've never imagined myself being in prison or anything like that. But it wasn't high security in the sense that we had prison guards and things like that. But it was definitely a lockdown situation, and real tough place. You had to meet certain requirements just to get a razor to shave your legs. And here I am, a 13, 14 year old girl going, I'm listening to my Cure and I'm shaving my legs. You know, so, you know, and I felt very fortunate that the people at the center were well versed in pissed off teenage girls, because I was probably a jerk for a good reason. But I remember it was Christmas and the governor came down to see us. Wow. Didn't do anything to change our lives, didn't do anything to make our lives better, but there was a great moment for the TV camera, right? And I want to say about a month later after Christmas, I had to go to court because my birth mother was in a different state. So now I'm in issue. Because why are they funding for a child in this state when the biological parent is in a different state? So I became a financial burden. My mother didn't want me. My father didn't want me. And now the state doesn't want me, damn it. So that's a lot to deal with when you're a kid. And I found out I had cervical cancer. And so that made it bigger.
Oh my God.
Because now here's this 14-year-old girl with cervical cancer who's a runaway. Which I didn't run away, I walked out. And so I remember looking at the judge, and the courtroom was filled with kids, you know, anywhere from like 12 to 17 or whatever. And I looked at the judge and I said, I will be your nanny. I will be your housekeeper. I will do absolutely anything possible.
Wow.
To not ship me back. And he reminded me that I was a burden of the state, not a warden, a burden. Because she lived in a different state. So I was granted my first airplane ride one way, nonstop, with a bodyguard or something. I don't remember what they called them at that time, but she was to ensure that I did not get off that plane even by jumping, by hook or crook. And we landed in this other state, and the person that came up to me to bring me home was her friend because she decided to take a weekend in Maine with her boyfriend. So you haven't seen your kid in maybe 2 years. You find out your kid's been living on the streets and has cancer, and you're three states away the first day back.
Wow.
So as you can sense, there wasn't a whole lot of love there. So it just got worse, progressively got worse. I think I was with her for another 6 months. She lived in a dorm room, like a dorm facility for families, and I wasn't allowed in her part. I had to live in the lobby because I was this horrible person. And I ended up having to get a ride from a friend to have my biopsies and things done to take care of some matters that are important. And she wasn't there for any of it. She would leave notes on the door that I was this rat fink and this horrible person. And just, it was very caustic, very toxic, very abusive. And it was like a Sunday night. She and her boyfriend were like, oh yeah, we're going to go camping for the weekend or something. And I didn't see them for about 3 years. So
3 years?
I ended up back in foster care. and so on and so forth. The great news is I have a bullish determination to get what I want, and not in a bad way. You know, I wanted to graduate high school. I did. I wanted to graduate college. I did. I wanted to build my own house. I did. And I lost absolutely everything, but I did. And that was really a key part to my healing, I think. That was all trauma response from being abused. So when I partnered with my ex-husband, that behavior continued because I was with yet another abuser. And it was all my fault. So I wasn't good enough. I didn't do enough. And it was the same kind of relationship that I had with my birth mother, except it was an adult. I don't like calling myself an adult, but technically I am with another adult in a partnership. And it was definitely a one-sided partnership.
So that didn't go well either.
No. It still isn't. And we've been divorced for 12 years. It's
out of the frying pan into the fire.
Yeah. I mean, I'm beyond Phoenix at this point.
I see what you did there.
Yeah, it was quick, huh?
So, Rusty, you've had abusive parents. Your mother abandoned you twice, it sounds like. You're homeless. You're in detention center. You went through all that. How did you just start pulling yourself up to get where you are?
So after trying hard to have a child and losing children through miscarriage, I finally got pregnant. And that was a terrifying experience because I was afraid anything that I did, I was going to lose this child. I'd already lost four prior. And 6 weeks after she was born, my little Rocket, I was dying.
Wow.
Yep. So I had a gallbladder issue, and they removed my gallbladder, which is very common with first-time pregnancies. But in the removal of the gallbladder, the stones got stuck in my bile duct, causing septic. I became septic and severely. I had about 72 hours to live. So fast forward, I'm lying in the hospital bed being told that I'm dying and that they have to put an emergency party together to open everything up and clean everything out so that I can do what my body's supposed to do, which is, you know, insert and exert. And my ex-husband sat there with my daughter, both my kids, my bonus child, his first wife's daughter, and my biological child, and he proclaimed that he didn't have time for this.
Oh, and my God.
The doctor looked at me, and I looked at the doctor, and I'm like, are you kidding me right now? Like, who has that kind of response when you just find out that your wife's dying?
And he said that right in front of the kids.
In front of the kids and the doctor. And so I had to really get good with my situation.
Wow. Well, that would sure be devastating. I mean, you keep rising from the ashes, like you say, this Phoenix idea. So there you're down in the ashes again. Your husband says he can't deal with it right in front of the kids. You could be dying there. Your daughter is, what, 6 months old, you said?
Well, my biological was 6 weeks old. I literally just had a baby. And my other one was 7, 8 years old. So I think I think it was so traumatic to realize what I had got myself into, because that was like the last punch in the face. Of course, this was metaphoric at the time, to realize what I had married, mm-hmm. and what I was stuck with. Okay. And so that was the day I decided I was leaving. But I had to figure out how to leave safely with the baby and how I was going to be supported.
So how did you go about that?
Well, I thought I was strategic. I thought I did it right. I had a great job. I got a place down the road from where he lived. I walked out of the house that I owned. I left most of my stuff. Amicably divorced. The judge even gave us pats on the back for being so civil. Little did I know, once I started dating, that's when the death threats started coming in. That's when the stalking started coming in. That's, you know, he just exponentially became really crazy. Like, and in the state of Maine and the state of New Hampshire, there are no protections at all, which I did not know. I was all pro cop and pro judge. And if you do everything right, you don't get a ticket and you're a good citizen. No, it's actually quite opposite. And it was very shocking, because I really am not a bad person and I didn't even have a parking ticket. And here I am in a situation where I genuinely needed help and I couldn't get it.
So he was stalking you, threatening you.
Yep. He got a gun, the whole thing. The judge, I had it all on recording too. And the judge refused to listen to his recording that he wanted me in the body bag.
Wow. And so there was no restraining order granted, anything like that?
I had to come to Florida to get a restraining order, which cost me 4 days in jail, because he claimed I kidnapped our daughter. So that was a whole long thing too. I want to say we were in court for about 9 years, over $23,000 in bills. My daughter has PTSD because of him. He choked her. It was very sad that night, because she was trying to call the police. He was screaming at her and he was doing this typical unstable thing. And he's 270 pounds and she was 7 years old. So maybe 60 pounds. And he jumped on her, holding her down to get the phone out of her hand, which was choking her. And the judge didn't do anything about it. And when I called the police said that because he didn't bruise her, there was nothing they could do about it. And that led me into a whole litany of, you know, if he raped her, just because he doesn't bruise her for raping her, that's okay. Like, just how your mind can go.
Wow.
And as long as she doesn't have a bruise on her body, it's considered parental something or other, parental rights to discipline your child. And that kind of put me on a warpath to make the whole world know what the truth is about the judicial system and how it does not work. And it pissed off a few people. So I'm kind of nervous about going up to New England when I do go.
Oh, boy. So was that kind of a turning point when that happened for you? Like, you just had enough and you started fighting the system?
Yes. And it wasn't necessarily fighting the system, but it was definitely standing up and saying that the system fails people and it fails children, where I've always been led to believe naively that if you needed help, it would be there. And in New Hampshire and Maine, it definitely is not. I remember the last court hearing that I had a couple of years ago. Chloe was 14. I think she was 14. And I looked at the judge and I said, I think it's really extraordinary how your state just passed a law where 14-year-old girls are allowed to get married, but my daughter doesn't have a voice in your courtroom. My daughter's not allowed to sit here and speak her truth and tell you who she wants to be with, but she can get married. She can't get a credit card. She can't drive a car. She can't vote. She can't even watch a rated R movie, but she can get married and have babies.
Kind of funny, because I always picture the Northeast as the most progressive part of the country for things like that.
Not for women's rights, not for domestic violence. Murder, suicide's pretty high up there. The system is actually set up to fail women and children. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing that more and more and more now. But, you know, we only got our rights to have our own checkbook in 1960. I was born in 76. So that's not too far away.
No. A lot closer than when I was born.
Right. And so as a woman, prospectively, I'm raising a female child, and I'm looking at her feeling very frustrated that if I were to die, she is not going to be protected.
Mm-hmm. Did you end up with sole custody of your daughter after that?
Because the state of New Hampshire does not allow children to speak in court, she is forced by mandate to visit her father on holidays. So that's where she is right now, and she's very miserable. And there's nothing I can do about it, because if I don't bring her, I go to jail.
That's where it stands as we speak. So this isn't over. It's just...
Well, she's seven. She just turned 17. So technically, it's over when she's 18. Hmm. But it's not over for me by any stretch of the imagination, because she's not the only child.
So you went through all this stuff. Kind of the culminating event was when your daughter was basically kidnapped. But now you are... traveling the world, or
it's fun because I actually host a podcast similar to yours. I do YouTube as well, and I travel around the world meeting people and sharing their stories. So the key is not having the resources and being a full-time single mom with zero support to keep us safe, because he wants me dead, so we have to be very cautious about that. Since I can't necessarily jettison around the world like I like to, this was the best bet, was to host a podcast, host a YouTube channel, and talk to people to find out what made them tick and what makes them work. And
So now, and your podcast or your YouTube channel is called Living and Thriving with Rusty.
So Living and Thriving with Rusty. I'm Rusty, and I want to learn myself to live life to the fullest and thrive. With everything that I've gone through, I've had many of opportunities to end my life. I've had many of opportunities to have my life ended for me, as you know. And so here I am, and just grabbing the bull by the horns and saying, I'm living to the fullest.
Well, Rusty, I know these things are totally difficult for you to talk about, and bringing back all these bad memories. So I really want you to know that we really appreciate you having the courage to share your story with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that's our show for today, folks. I'd like to thank my three guests, Mike Feeney, Tom McAuliffe, and Rusty McDonald, for sharing their inspiring stories. And don't you dare move, because Charles Hightower is up next with R&B Gold, a sweet mix of soul music. This is Eric Keene, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we want you to always remember that it's never too late to live happily ever after.
This is KPFT.
Life in Focus, or LIF, presents lively, diverse, and sometimes controversial topics. Life features interviews, commentaries, and discussions that stimulate conversations around contemporary issues in politics, education, economics, women's issues, health and safety, history, entertainment, music, art, spoken word, relationships, and everyday life, all with an Afrocentric flavor. Anell Williams, producer-host, has a no-nonsense cut-to-the-chase style that is provocative and simply refreshing. Life in Focus with Anell Williams, Monday afternoons, 3 to 4 p.m., here on 90.1 KPFT.
The Flower Power Hour with Ken and MJ.
This week on the Flower Power Hour.
It's time to talk about a sweet child in time. She's passing the time by asking, does anybody really know what time it is?
What?
She does know that you cannot squeeze time out of mind, that only time will tell, and that time waits for no one. And there comes a time she realizes that the time has come today.
Find out what this means. The Flower Power Hour. You're listening.